This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Spinning Straw into Gold, Art, Value, and the Alchemical Collector, a panel discussion held in conjunction with the exhibition An Ordinal of Alchemy. The discussion featured artists Robert Williams, Mark Dion, and Sal Randolph, along with the scholar Mackenzie Wark, and was moderated by historian of science D. Graham Burnett. It took place on March 27th, 2010.
I'm an editor at Cabinet Magazine, and joining me on the panel is a distinguished host of interesting folk. There's a kind of an austere silence in the room, which befits these grave subjects that we'll be discussing for the next hour or so. So we're here to celebrate an opening, an Ordinal of Alchemy, a show organized by Robert Williams and Mark Dion, and realized at Mildred's Lane by a set of young artists we'll be mentioning by name in turn. So the format for this discussion is going to run like this. Mark, who's at the right end, and Robert are going to get us going. Robert will start by talking a little bit about how this project evolved at Mildred's Lane. Mark will pick up some of the themes, alchemy, collecting, importantly, questions of the Wunderkammer and value. And then we'll pull back out, and both Sal Randolph and Mackenzie Wark, who are to my right, will pick up on the themes, and then we'll open the floor. So, to get us going, I'll just say a word about the conceit for this show. Those of you who read in the material will have seen that the task we charged when we dreamed up this scheme, task we charged Mark and Robert with was as follows. Build a show for $999 under a single constraint. Everything in the show has to be acquired on eBay. And here is the rationale moving forward. After we've shown the show, we will put the whole show back up on eBay and sell it as a single work. And the problematic there is this question of value, and yet to be determined whether what we have is a surplus value or the notorious negative surplus value to be discussed over the next few minutes. And one of the questions we hope this panel will resolve is what's to be done with surplus value if indeed we end up with some. So that's one of the things we'll be talking about. So it was that task, build a show within $999 that we gave to Mark and Robert, and maybe I'll let Robert take over telling us how he integrated that charge into a session.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you, everybody, for feeding back already. First, I'd like to introduce actually the people who put this together. These are the fellows from the Mildred's Lane project that we took part in over last summer. So if I could ask for those fellows present to stand when I read their name, we just need to kind of welcome you and say thank you for what you've done. So Max Bettin, if you're there, Max.
I can hear you very well.
Okay. Yeah. Joey Cruz. Catherine Cornelius. Hiya. Gabriella Italia. Scott Jarrett can't be with us at the moment, but we'll wave to him anyway. Ashlyn Pentecost Farran. John Monzel. Laura Wertheim. And Brian Wilson. Hurrah. There we go. So thank you all. You'll see why that's so significant as we go through the next little bit of my talk. It's worthwhile pointing out that the project on which the 999 project rests actually began about 12 years ago at Mildred's Lane. when those running Mildred's Lane invited me to take part in a project, an installation that would become somewhere for people to stay. The idea behind this, of course, was really to do with the idea of perhaps flight from the old world to the new for somebody who might feel persecuted. And as with any expat, one takes the idea of home with you. And this is the central idea to a project. But the person we wanted to take flight, of course, was an alchemist. And so we began to think about how and why this alchemist might travel to the new world, what this alchemist might take, what kind of ideas and thoughts of the alchemist. And so here we have one element, a maquette from that installation proposal. This is a Nature Morte, a vitrine with the king and the queen, the skeletons underneath the bed, based on the idea of as above, so below, a very prominent alchemical idea. And of course the alchemist would take along various apparatus and appurtenances to continue the craft, as it were, in the new world, free from persecution from the old. And here are some of the items that we might find in that shack. Of course, the retorts and glassware were all made at RISD some years later than the project began. So moving on to the actualization of that project in the summer, we began a three-week project with the fellows that I've just introduced to you. It was a kind of a seminar program as much as anything else. The hard physical labor involved in building a structure was all part of it, but a great deal of what we were doing was engaging in a discourse about the ideas that might be generated by the thought of alchemy and various other issues arising from that. One of the things we were interested in were alchemical processes. And here we have an 18th century illustration of those alchemical processes within practical alchemy. Once we knew about the 999 project, or the eBay project, we decided that this would become the frame for the decisions that we would make. As you can imagine, eBay is wide open for anything and everything, but we needed somehow to focus our decision making. And so the seven doors of practical alchemy became absolutely what the project was all about. So these are the seven doors. Calcination, of course, in our case, it was all about the removal of volatile fractions, which is a rather lovely idea. Post-corpus ossiferous material was very important. I doubt whether you can read that at the back. Fixation is the next category, which is all about the transformation of these substances to be made solid and less volatile. But it was also about deep focus and obsessions.
Let me interrupt you for just a minute. I think because of the feedback, because this mic worked real good, let me give you this mic, and if you want to just turn off this lavalier, and then let's see if that means we'll stop getting that.
Okay, is that any better?
Yeah, it's okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Much better.
Fantastic. How intimidating. Solution then is our next category, which is all about mixtures and two or more substances meeting. But it's also about causal guidance, one thing leading to another, of course. Distillation, separation of mixtures, but of course it also means consideration, rumination, thinking. Sublimation is about solids to gas, but it's also about the idea of the sublime itself, things beyond the normal run of things. And separation, literal and metaphoric, the idea of the abject, perhaps. And then projection, base metal or a base substance becoming something else through the process of transmutation or transformation. So these are the categories that informed our decision making of the project, and each of the fellows would team up with another, and off we would go debate those things and find objects that more or less matched those ideas, and here we are doing it. The hermeneutical process itself was fascinating. It was all about how we might identify these things, how we might indicate those things with a mind to an audience meeting that and attempting to find out what was going on. Of course, it was incredible fun at the same time. And particularly so when the moment of enlightenment happened, as in this case. This, I think, was the last second where we managed to buy the Philosopher's Stone, the actual Philosopher's Stone. And we were waiting for the last eBay moment, and there it was. We achieved what we set out to do. But of course, all that base material, that primer materia, finds its way here, and it lived in Sina's house for 6 months, I think. So, sorry, Sina. But here we are with this amazing collection of packages, all beautifully labelled for the attention of Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum, which is rather lovely. Okay, we had a problem then. We had an enormous amount of material, enormous amount of packaging, lots of ideas, but we needed a vehicle to frame it, something to contain it. This is Thomas Norton's Cosmos. Thomas Norton is the man who gives us the title of the exhibition, The Ordinal of Alchemy. And that original was part of Ashmole's Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum, which was itself a compendia of alchemical ideas collected by Elias Ashmole. The metaphor here is the ethanol, the alchemist's oven, where the creative processes take place, where our seven doors of alchemy, the process of those take place. And it activates our great work in this furnace of creativity, and that's what you find behind you, ladies and gentlemen. Here's the model, which didn't happen until, 3 days ago? About 3 or 4 days ago, before we finally reached that level of completeness, as it were. And the rest, I think, is really up to you. It's really all about you engaging with that object and thinking about the objects that are in. So, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I think probably. Do you want to see if yours is working?
I think it seemed to be working before. Josh, how we doing? Let's not risk that. Then.
That's
slightly
looked at by
Darling. Okay. You have images.
I'd like to have some images too, but since I'm an analog man in this digital world, I'll be showing some slides. So I want to discuss, or rather outline, a few notions about the idea of value, marketplace, and trade in the tradition of the Curiosity Cabinet. Since fundamentally, the Cabinet magazine assignment posed to the Mildred's Lane Fellows was to build a Wunderkammer for $999, only using eBay. So that makes sense to go back to the source. As you can see from my first slide, $999 goes a little bit further in 1655 than it does today. In 1655, when Graham and Sina first proposed this to a group in the town of Aarhus. So this is hardly an audience that requires an introduction to pre-Enlightenment European collections, but there are a few things that are rarely talked about in discussion of the curiosity cabinets in the 16th to the 18th century. One is that they were extremely numerous. From 1586 to 1735, there were over 200 of these private collections within the borders of the Netherlands alone. Next slide, please. They housed natural objects or specimens, artifacts, art, antiquities, ethnographic objects, new technologies, and they could be arranged with a somewhat shocking lack of purpose, or they could be play on a kind of Noah-like symmetry, a march of two of everything, or rigorous taxonomic orders which might reflect allegorical significance or moralizing tableaus. Next slide, please. Or they could represent cosmological important social exchanges. For learned gentlemen scholars, merchants, and aristocrats, the collections were an obvious reflection of their own knowledge and wealth. They also had far-reaching roles in pomp, diplomacy, and the politics of hosting. Next slide, please. The materials from these cabinets could be supplied by an organized network of curiosity dealers, often located in the proximity of the harbor. Generally sailors who made little or no money on their global voyages, preferring the comforts of the ship to being homeless in town, By acquiring shell specimens, corals, strange stones, live animals, exotic weapons and tools, a sailor could earn an important income selling that to professional shops. Dealers had client lists and sold objects at significant profits. Numerous collectors also haunted the docks and struck deals with captains and crew members independently. A number of guidebooks and catalogs were available, some of which advised gentlemen collectors on prices, gave detailed inventories. Even travel guides for curiosity cabinets were written, advising which collections could be seen, in which towns, and how to best gain access to them. Several how-to manuals were available for those who wished to collect and build a cabinet. Next slide, please. One could collect purely natural specimens. Next slide. Objects such as shells, prepared animal skins, bones, rocks, minerals, corals, sponges, pressed plants and seeds. This was also a link to the pursuit of the next economic viable product. Who would be the next to introduce a new tobacco, a chocolate, a coffee? The New World was an endless source of novel specimens. Next slide, please. Art objects, Greek and Roman antiquities, Egyptian antiquities, could also be amassed. Next slide. Perhaps, for the question of value, one of the most interesting examples are objects which hybridize the natural and the artificial. Shark's teeth, gilded in silver, which were said to have the power of neutralizing poison when they're dipped into a drink. Carved ivory and ebony, shells made into cups. Next slide, please. The notion of craftsmanship as enhancing the power of nature, bringing out nature's true soul, is an important part of this notion. It should not also be forgotten that the semiotic of these objects is also complex and obtuse. Next slide. And that many have not only a value as material wealth, but also a very real fetishistic or magic value, such as offering protection or allowing for seeing into the future, clarifying relationships that exist. Next slide. Lastly, one of the great values, even amongst the natural rarities of the New World, were anomalies in nature, strange births, monsters, wondrous fruits, doubled seeds, and strange animals provide another category of value. For if the collection is somehow about reproducing the order of nature in an attempt to understand the workings of the Creator, where would you better find clues in those methods than in the mistakes and exceptions to the rules? Next slide. Today we think of museums and collections as static places. However, early collections were dynamic. They were more like today's research collections or baseball card collections. Objects were traded or sold. Collectors brought gifts and swapped things. They were handled, smelled, and tasted. Eventually, these collections, with their hyper-interactive activity, give way to collective collecting of learned men and become the incubations of the scientific collections of the next generations. Thank you.
So we have a considerable number of threads in the room, and as the conversation's been proceeding, I've tried to pick up on a few of them, and it'll be, in some sense, to our panelists to pull out a few more, but at least in part, we have a show that is significantly engaged with alchemy as something more than a metaphor, although certainly there's a kind of metaphorical register that's being invoked. We have the kind of stunt-like dimension of the 999 show, which is a kind of performance in the marketplace through the eBay dimension. So that's another thread, it seems to me, we may want to pick up on. And we have this larger question of collecting and the collection as both an artistic process and as a means of creating value, or as significantly engaged with value. And Mark mentioned fetishism, and I think for those of you who've had a chance to mill around the stove, the furnace, you'll have already sensed a kind of fetishistic dimension to the project as a whole. And there is a way in which Marx floats over this conversation, the commodity as fetish. And so I think we should have that too in the room. Maybe I'll hand things over first to Sal. Sal, do you want to pick up on some of this? And then I'll come back to Ken and see where we are.
Should we get the microphone? I mean, I can turn it back up. I think this was...
My mic might be different. Now, this, can you hear me? I think we're better off with the... I can turn this off physically here.
Yeah, go for this.
Okay. This mic is working. Yes, I hear. Okay, hi. So one of the titles of this event is Spinning Straw into Gold, and that obviously has a kind of alchemical dimension, that lead into gold idea, but it also has, for me, a fairy tale dimension, obviously, and there happened to be a time in my life where I was thinking about this phrase all the time. It came right to mind as I was thinking about what to talk about today. I was making a big artwork out of these. I don't know if you're familiar with these. They used to be called pipe cleaners, but they're now called chenille stems. If you need to buy any, that's what you have to look it up on eBay as. They're a little bit fluffier and longer than the old pipe cleaner. Actually, they're not quite the same form factor. And they've been removed from their original purpose of cleaning to this purely playful and aesthetic purpose for hobbyists and children. So there's a whole market in this sort of useless pipe cleaner. And of course, they look a little bit like straw. So I thought I'd pass around to everybody a straw. I happen to have still a few hundred left from this project. I have a lovely system there. It starts out to take one. And maybe you'll all have some success in making that into gold. As I was working on this project, it was really, really laborious. And my work at that time was actually all about the labor of making. And I couldn't help but notice that it had, in part, this absurd quality. So I was perfectly serious about it on one level, but on another level, it felt absurd. And one of the things I was thinking about, I hadn't actually read Marx's Capital at the time, but I had this intuition, which when I came across it in his book, made complete sense to me. So if you think, if you have a labor theory of value and you think of the value in all the objects around us as a kind of congealed form of the labor that went into making them, you still have to account for useless labor. So he talked about how if you, no matter how hard you work on something, how creatively and beautifully and ferociously you work on something, if it doesn't enter into the world of money, it is in some important way valueless or useless. So you can have useful labor or valuable labor, and you can also have this useless or valueless labor. And since I happen to know that this installation, while it was shown and everything, but it was never going to be bought or sold, I was aware as I was making it, even without this specific reading, of the uselessness of the labor. And I was specifically kind of interested in this idea of art and art making as a useless, as this sort of passionate uselessness. And in the sort of Marxist point of view, one of the things I was doing was actually destroying the value of my labor every day as I spent 8 or so hours twisting pipe cleaners. So the potential value of my labor was being rendered into actual useless value. So I've become kind of interested in the destruction of value as well as the creation of value because of that. And one of the things we were talking about in the back was that the art world has two aspects to it. There's a writer and artist, wonderful guy named Gregory Cholet, who's written about the dark matter of the art world. And his idea is that we perceive a part of the art world that roughly can be coextensive with, let's say, the contents of Art Forum. maybe Cabinet, the Venice Biennale, the Whitney Biennial, et cetera, et cetera. This sort of small group of activities, publications, and artists, which are very, very visible and include a lot of commodities, or at least in a way, financially valuable artworks. But then there's also this giant activity, actually much, much, much larger, which consists of grandmas painting their pets on Sundays, and people with MFAs who go off and disappear and are never heard from again. And there's just this huge activity that has, in the way that dark matter, the sort of physics idea about the universe of the stars that we see, there may also be this kind of matter that we can't see that's much, much bigger and exerts a kind of gravitational pull. The dark matter of the art world, this art that largely exists outside of financial circulation and is done for all kinds of other reasons and is hidden, is what supports the visible part of the art world. So it means that the reason we can buy reasonably priced art supplies is partly because all kinds of people are painting unremuneratively. So or for that matter, even lots and lots of professional artists, you see only a tiny amount of what they produce. So, or you can see the way in which it takes thousands and thousands of spectators to support a museum like MoMA. So there's this element of gravitational force from what we don't see as well as what we do see, and from activities which destroy value in one way or another, that take this perfectly commodifiable tube of paint, which you can buy or sell on eBay, and turn it into a painting which actually has less value than the tube of paint. So, and I bought some of those paintings. I have a kind of a collection of flea market and yard sale paintings, including paint by numbers paintings, which is another perfect example of that kind of activity. So I think I'll just let it go there.
That's great. Ken, perfect.
Oh, there's so many things going on in this show. Those wonderful photos of Cabinets of Curiosities made me think about when did the split start to really happen between the idea of collecting objects of scientific value and collecting objects of artistic value. And it makes me think of a wonderful book by Bernard Smith called European Vision in the South Pacific, which was about a split in ways of representing the world that comes about, at least in his reading, because the South Pacific just brought so many weird things back that they weren't classifiable according to sort of the Platonic order of forms that was the kind of accepted way of understanding how things were ordered. And that had not only scientific consequences, it had aesthetic consequences, that it changed in a sense what art was about as well. That it was difficult to make art based on the concept of the ideal of what a landscape or a natural form was supposed to be. When there no longer was a given order of forms, there were all these forms that didn't fit the particular order. So you get a kind of a sense that what one might be looking for is not the ideal form, but typical forms, and that representation might now become about typical things rather than ideal things. And so we get wonderful, wonderful images that usually aren't classified as art, but every expedition that the French or the British sent to the Pacific contained artists who had to try to picture what it was that they saw. At a certain point in the 18th century, every British seaman was taught how to draw. And the reason was strategic. If you were able to actually draw what a landform looked like, you could find it again and attack it or defend it and so on. And out of this comes the sort of the split between the Royal Academy and the Royal Society, where there's no longer one space within which representation and the discovery of knowledge are the same, and we sort of start to separate them out. So we have different kinds of collections now. But I'm thinking also about the kind of everyday collecting that goes on. There was wonderful stuff about exactly how these objects would start to appear in collections, and you could sort of flesh out an entire global political economy of how objects come to be in possession of certain people. How does a seashell find its way from one side of the world to the other? What kinds of labor involved? What kinds of transactions? And so on. But it makes me think we have something like that in a somewhat, debased form, in the sense that you can now kind of collect pretty much anything and have at least your immediate desires for what to collect immediately fulfilled. I had this personal experience that I used to collect books. And you know, there was just books I knew it would take me years and years to get. And if I was living in Australia, right, if I went to England, there were certain bookstores I had to go to see if I could find, you know, a rare edition of, you know, whatever it was that I was looking for. And my entire, like, collecting life was destroyed by the fact that the internet just meant you just looked it up, you know, and you could just get anything you could possibly need, you know. So everything on my list I got in the space of about a month. And I just sort of ran up the credit card, and it's like, oh, I want that, and I want that. And I sort of realized, oh, all the pleasure's gone out of it. You know, like, I would just be like pouring through lists on the internet. It's not the same thing as the physical practice of having to go from one place to the other. But I'm sure there are many people for whom the fact of eBay, and I was doing this even before eBay, imagine how easy it is now, makes collecting a whole different thing. Now, I'm sure there's a whole dimension of eBay that's to do with objects of necessity. But is there not a whole dimension of it that's to do with objects that are pure surplus? China dolls that can be dressed in all kinds of, if it's to your taste, exquisite ways. And you can get their outfits. And Fisher-Price little people, you know, I thought I'd get them for my kids. It turns out people collect them and they're 50 to 100 bucks, you know. And there's such a thing as good played with condition. You know, you can imagine what that means. Like, it includes teeth marks, you know. But you've still got all the pieces. So, besides the sort of the dark matter of the art world, is there not then the dark matter of the thing that doesn't even count as art, but is collecting nonetheless? There are all these other kinds of collecting with which one then kind of ends up. So yeah, is eBay where all our stuff goes to die? You know, like it has this sort of second life before it ends up in the dump, you know, that it will all circulate it once more and then we'll throw it away. I kind of wonder if that's the process that we've now ended up with. And, you know, one of the things that one wants art to do is to go out and kind of explore in a sort of naive, but in a good way, naive set of possibilities and relationships, because we all have these preconceptions about what something is. So let's go and make a work based on collecting stuff on eBay and see what we end up with. And we'll sell. It's just like, you know, there is a certain obvious conceptual joy to this, but there's a certain naivety in not using eBay for what you normally use it for. We'll do something else with it. And see if we construct a new category of what the relationship between value and art might be. And maybe we won't, but maybe we will. Maybe there's something interesting in it. All right, so what is the relationship between art and value? And it seems to me that there are several possible ways that you could think about it. One is art as an ideal form of labor. That when an artist works, and the example would be painter or sculptor, when an artist works in this fashion, this is what labor should be. But labor for most of us is not like this. You know, labor is industrial, or it's the sort of seeming meaninglessness of office work. It's not labor that involves the kind of the aesthetic and the productive together. So there's that idea of what how value and art come together. But there's also the idea of art as the perfect commodity, because the thing that the artist is supposed to produce is singular. So it's the one thing that can be kind of authorized and sold as a commodity that can't be replicated and debased. So there's that kind of notion of value in art. But then there's the idea of art that might escape from exchange altogether. Is there a way in which art cannot be the commodity, can, if you like, dematerialize itself to the point where it takes the quality of information to be what it's about rather than the quality of material things, and so it will kind of escape altogether. And then one that's just occurred to me, because I did both the recent Tino Segal show and the one before that, which was this situation. When you do 4-hour shifts for an artist, you get a lot of time to think about what the hell the artwork's about. And it occurred to me that you could create art that is sold in exchange, but where there's no object whatsoever. So it's actually the reverse of the dematerialization of the object. It's completely commodified, but there's no thing there whatsoever, absolutely nothing. And that made me think of other, like, weird art practices that have sort of tried to confound this question of art and value. And I'll just mention two. I very much love the paintings of Basque Yuan, who for a while was collecting paintings from flea markets and painting over the top of them. And he would interestingly always leave the central figure or motif from the Sunday painter, you know, that he found in the flea market, and sort of there'd be stuff, you know, it's detournement, it's like correction, it's like corrected around the edges. And famously, when he did them in the first series, is 58, he does them until I think it's 62. They were very unpopular. Like, his dealers didn't want them. You know, he couldn't sell them. He mostly gave them to people who actually could find you know, ways to make a living by selling these works that he gave them. And they're now the most, one of the most precious things Yuan ever did. You know, they're now the super valued piece of work. But it comes from taking junk and adding to it and transforming it. And the other example I just wanted to mention was K Foundation, who were doing things like strapping a 20-pound note to a brick and then selling it for 20 pounds. And so you sort of, all right, I could spend this 20 pounds, that would buy me in London probably a drink and a half, I guess, at the moment. You know, I had a couple of drinks on that. Or I could leave it strapped to the brick and maybe it would appreciate in value in the future, right? Maybe it's going to be worth 100 pounds if I don't actually drink the 20 pounds that's available there for the taking, you know. And of course, I have to mention the famous work where they put £1 million in a pile and allegedly set it on fire. Worth mentioning because the journalists who came stole some of the money and it had to be replaced before they could even get fired. Never trust an art journalist. So I just mentioned these as examples of you know, maybe, you know, in the wonderful sense of the naive, the one thing art can do is explore the domain of the relation between art and value and come up with a mapping of that terrain. It's not as if you get to overthrow it, but you can at least map it and find the little points of egress into other ways in which value might be created and other kinds of economy might exist. So, we have work. I'm so happy you showed all of the boxes because they're in the back room at the moment and I was just fetishizing. You know, this is not one of the conditions that makes this sort of work possible. You know, that the post actually works, you know, the delivery works, stuff will come to your front door, you know. Like, we take for granted that dimension of it. All right, so stuff is amassed, it's put together in a new work, costs $999. This does not include the labor, right? This does not include the labor, this is just the materials. You sell it for more than $999. What do you do with the surplus? And this might be the question. The panel was asked to address this, and of course we have no answer whatsoever. Because the panelists, you know.
Said we light it on fire, right?
Yeah. Isn't that right? That would be, if you made more money than the $999, my first thought would be to set it on fire. Let's have a little party and burn the money, you know. But of course, the people who contributed the labor might feel quite otherwise. You know. But on the other hand, is it something you really should get paid for? Because it's just luck if you made more money selling something on eBay than you got it for. Yeah, there's a certain casino-like quality to this. There is no surplus value involved. It's the fluctuations of circulation. So maybe it should be taken to Atlantic City and gambled. You know, this would be another appropriate solution that I could possibly offer for what would happen should there be surplus. And the last question that I want to leave everybody with is, what if the thing sells for less than $999? I haven't really kind of thought about that because we're so optimistic, you know. But yeah, should we take up a collection now, you know, to cover the contingency that we don't make the threshold? But I will just leave it there with those random speculations. Thank you.
It's worth saying that if we may have to go back to our benefactor if, in fact, we sell for less money, hit him up for more money. There is a merchant prince behind the show in one regard. The $999 that made this show possible was a gift from Paul Singh, a private equity banker up in Massachusetts. Sorry he can't be with us, but is, I'm sure, delighted to think that we are thinking so hard about these questions of exchange in the market. Couldn't be here with us because he actually has an actual business meeting today where he's thinking about how to keep the artists in filthy lucre. So I think probably what we want to do is go to the room for some questions because the panel's loaded up the table. There was one way I thought we might pull a thread together. I'm quite struck by Sal's offering us this idea of the dark matter of the art world, this kind of circulating invisibility that holds the visible portion of the art world in place, makes it possible for it to cohere and be visible. And that notion of a kind of primordial invisibility that makes everything else possible signals to me a fundamentally alchemical principle, right? Because at the heart of the alchemical quest, alchemists, in a strange way, prefiguring the playful artist who is a kind of bandit with respect to traditional notions of value, right? Destabilizing figures who are forever at the edges, beckoning the possibility that they could produce money, specie, and therefore destabilize the traditional markets of exchange, devalue currency. So there's a parallel there. The alchemist's central preoccupation was with the materia prima, the kind of primordial matter, that unformed pre-substance that, if one could get control of it, could be transmuted into gold or silver, etc., etc. And I wondered if those of you who've been thinking a little bit more about alchemy and explicitly have any thoughts about that question of the alchemist's quest for that primordial substance that can give him or her control over value, and whether that constitutes a direct parallel to the way the artist sort of is trying to create value out of that darkness, that is to be seen, to become part of the visible of the art world.
But possibly. I'm always minded of alchemists, really, when they promise princes and potentates that they can make gold out of lead. You know, that's a very easy way to get 20 years worth of bed and board without actually doing anything, other than chasing your own dreams of enlightenment, of achieving godhead, which of course is really what the alchemists wanted. Actually, their ideas, their thoughts, were completely beyond the prima materia, in a sense, beyond the earthly realm, because they actually wanted to join with the deity. But the earthly body needs to be sustained, and I think that those alchemists that did hang out with princes would say, I'll have you some gold in next year. Give me some more time, and then next year they would produce a little bit of gold, and you know, who knows where that came from, and that would keep the prince happy for another year, and so on. So, in a sense, I suppose from what you were saying there, Graham, I think from the alchemist's point of view, it's really not very interesting. It's very interesting to donors, and it's very interesting to benefactors, but not at all interesting to alchemists. Of course, there's another category in there, and that's the charlatan, who is very interested in the gold and the riches as well. But I mean, throughout you know the years when this was going on, you have these kind of different. Different stories of alchemists managing to support themselves or not, you know, or finding themselves thrown in jail, they were discovered for what they were doing. But it always seems to me much more interesting to those surrounding alchemists or even persecuting alchemists that those conditions applied. And in that sense, I think alchemists are a little bit like artists, because you can't possibly do it for the money, can you? You just can't.
Mark, artists as alchemists spinning straw into gold?
Okay, first I want to make my plug for what I think should happen. And this is a very optimistic, okay? I think that ideally, of course, this will sell for, I mean,
millions.
I don't even know how many zeros I could actually put on that calculation, but that the original 999 should be returned to Cabinet as seed money for the next project, where whatever is left from that should, of course, be gold should be purchased and placed into the cabinet safe back here, which you've carefully put, anticipating that moment. So, but I think you know what one of the things that really interests me was this notion of art as the perfect commodity, in a sense, and it is a very unusual commodity if you think about the example that Marx is always using of the coat, right? And the coat is always, he's always talking about the all of the aspects of the raw materials, the labor, as somehow being reflected in the coat and the coat's use value. And the artwork is a very modern commodity in that sense that it doesn't have, that's not an aspect of it. A painting, the how much it costs to produce a painting is utterly irrelevant to the symbolic value that we give it. And the labor and how much time it takes to make that work is utterly irrelevant. So it is this incredible commodity where a very symbolic commodity where the use value is utterly devoid. In the same way that maybe some of the objects in the original collections have a very their value is not really in where they were found or even necessarily their rarity, but maybe in their use value as a kind of magic value that these things had, that you, if you have your unicorn horn, that it has a very strong protective value. It will announce for you the presence of a betrayer or a traitor. Your shark's tooth will purify your wine of poison, and you know, there are many objects which have this kind of very complex and strange value. And I find that that's an interesting way of thinking about this incredibly strange surplus value that is free floating.
So what about the politics of the question? So when Marx wants to identify the commodity as a fetish, he's doing so because he understands there to be tremendous stakes if people can learn to see that their previous connection to the value of a commodity is merely the fetishization of that object and a betrayal of the labor that it represents. Well, then the whole thing will come shaking down. And we were talking in the back, the section in Capital, in section 4 of the introduction, where he first alludes to the commodity as this metaphysical, theological mystification, he has this strange footnote where he says commodities shiver with their kind of transcendental power the way that the china shakes. And the line he gives in French is pour encourager les autres, to make everybody else join in. And he's almost certainly referring there to an earthquake, where the china is the first thing that shakes, but it's telling you, right, that the whole fucking thing is about to come down on you. And it's a deliciously charged way to kind of draw your attention to how important it is to understand the commodity as merely a fetish. And there's been a lot, I mean, obviously the work of art, too, is supposed to do a certain kind of political labor. Is there a way in which making an intervention in the marketplace through these works of art, like you were talking about, Ken, that are sort of savvy and gaming and prankster-like, do those end up having any bite against this titanic circulation of the market?
Yeah. It might be helpful just to say a little bit about fetish, which is a word that comes from the Portuguese contact with African trading communities. And the thing was, how do you make a contract with somebody who won't swear on the Bible, or for whom doing so is meaningless, right? And what they found is their trading partners were swearing on what they took to be fetish objects. And it turns out it was an incredibly elaborate set of commercial practices that their partners were bound by, but the Western traders didn't understand it at all. And so they thought that people really believed there's magic power in the objects that they're making the contract around. It doesn't occur to them that they find a magic value in the books that they're making the contract around. You know, the reason I'm unearthing this is that maybe, and we started to think fetish through Freud for a long time, which I actually find not very helpful, but maybe what fetish is about is the complete incommensurability of different systems of value, which is maybe where art starts to get interesting, is how do you create practices, objects, non-objects, non-practices, where you can actually create complete incommensurabilities of value, where somebody else just absolutely cannot perceive how something has value, and therefore it must be a fetish. You must be attributing magic power to something, because the value to me is not obvious. So that, to me, would be the larger frame for thinking about, you know, why these things might be interesting. The beauty of something like eBay is it's almost like a universal index of fetishism, right? Because it presupposes for every single trade, you know, in economic theory, it's supposed to be that you've arrived at the agreed value, but it's actually sort of not. Is that you always think that the other person is misvalued, otherwise you wouldn't make the trade, right? That's sort of really what happens. That it's a universal index of fetishism, which might be the reason it's interesting for an artist to work in that particular space of sort of buying and selling things. The other element, of course, is the recombination, which brings us back to Wunderkammer. To what extent is the value to do with the proximity of one object to another? Like, a seashell's not worth a lot unless you've got a whole bunch of other seashells, you know. Then you have a collection and you have relationships and so on. But that's art, yeah? Art only has value in relation to other works of art. You know, it's like a combinatory system.
So, Sal, you've got an interest in the kind of anarchist line on some of this question of, you know, art being the place where incommensurable theories of value intersect more, maybe?
Definitely, there? But one of the... I was thinking about, I've been reading the anarchist anthropologist David Graeber's work. He talked quite interestingly about the fetish in Africa, too. But one of the things he's trying to do is figure out how to talk about values, i.e. the things that we care about in society, and value, i.e. money, in the same kind of sentence. And how we make a bridge between those two things. It's actually quite difficult to get those two ideas to talk to each other. And he spends a whole book trying and doesn't entirely, I think, even get there. Although he has a kind of a theory that actions might be a way to look at it rather than objects. But one of the things he points out is that when we start to talk about values, ideals, we're generally talking about areas where the market hasn't fully penetrated. I mean, we think of our current capitalist society, we think of it as being completely totalizing, as we can't think outside of this market that's going on all the time. But actually, there are areas of our lives that we defend, sometimes vigorously, against the market. And I was hearing a talk recently by Larry Lessig, who's a lawyer who talks about intellectual property, and he's one of the founders of Creative Commons. And he was talking about how conservatives, who we think of as being so devoted to the market, actually defend the boundary between market and non-market transactions more vigorously than liberals do. In particular, he was saying that using money to pay for sex, they find really much more egregious than liberals do. So that there are these areas that we keep outside of the market. And I was thinking, you know, just as a thought experiment, not really as a utopia, but what if in our world, we had the same taboo, social taboo, about exchanging money for art that we do about exchanging money for sex? And what set of changes would ripple out? Like, for one thing, immediately it follows we'd have a black market for art, where we would be doing that, but illegally or immorally. And it supposes that we would really desire art in a way that we're not always sure, as a society, I think, at large, that we actually do value and desire art, although obviously some subsets do very much. So I've been trying to kind of think through some of those consequences.
That's great. So I think we should open up the floor. Black market for art, black matter in art, black arts.
I think it's the gentleman.
Hey, I was really bothered by the idea of the dark matter in art, and I've been thinking about this the whole time, because it seems sad that a person, a human being, and what they do in their life is not part of the universe or not part of our shared world, and that's very sad to me. But I feel like that also that idea says something about the kind of like the value that the art objects have. And it seems sort of like, well, and then this leads me, I haven't said anything yet, but I have a question. I guess I want to start by asking a question about like the context in which the Wonder Camera existed. Like, what kind of value did those things that were put in there have at the time? Because in this kind of show where you take things that are crap, like we have a lot of crap now, and we all know that there's this crap that exists in the world, and it's just mountains of crap, and we feel burdened by the crap, and like this, there's this need to stop that and to make it into something that isn't crap, and we want to believe that there it's possible still to have things that are not crap. So I see the effort of this kind of work to be this like defense against being useless and being useless people and people that produce crap. So I don't know, is the and you know, that's sort of the alchemical thing, these alchemists who couldn't do anything, and so they made all these promises about creating value, and they did create value because there was an economy surrounding that, so they were good advertising people, I guess. But so I guess the question is, what Was there a similar disruption of value happening at that time that was being sort of attempted to be thwarted by the collecting?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's almost exactly the opposite.
That's why this may work.
Prepare for the worst. I think it's almost exactly the opposite, that most of the things that were valued for very traditional reasons, for reasons of rarity, and for reasons of having particular powers, for reasons of being of great art, great accomplishments and craftsmanship, that combination of a highly crafted imposition onto a natural object as making that natural object even more valuable, and in some way kind of teasing out its essence even better. So I don't really see that. I mean, I see that as a kind of period in which these values are very much established. I don't see that as a period in which that there was a kind of going against the grain of things.
I feel the second question there, which maybe can come to Robert, which is, to what extent was this project, in your view, conceived as an effort to redeem the crop?
Right. Yeah, thanks. I think it was... It's an interesting way to put it. Of course, what alchemists are all about was getting away from the crap, as it were. The whole thing recognized that human beings are actually in it, as it were. That model of Norton's cosmos there, right at the bottom, where Satan lives, is actually where all the ashes and the filth from the fire end up. It's about transcending that to actually join with God. That's not to sit next to God, but to become God. That was the entire point of alchemy, that level of enlightenment, that level of conceit was what it was all about. And of course, you have to get through all the crap to do that. And those are very, very clear kind of medieval ideas working their way through, based on the idea of the three kings, where, you know, where the beggar meets the three kings who are cadavers, and there's this, you know, it's kind of I too dwell in Arcadia, you know, we're all heading for literally crap, we're going to be worm food. So you try to transcend that. And in a sense, there was a bit of that going on, because the kind of stuff we were looking at when we were deciding on the categories and looking at eBay and buying them, the things that really made us get very excited and happy were the really kitschy things. And there's something transcendental about taking an empty ragu jar from somebody that has the essence of Jeffrey the Ghost in it, you know. And yes, that's worth a dollar or five or whatever it is. And similarly, you know, we were picking up stuff there which is clearly a lie. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a dragon skull in that, which is transcending the beasts that made it up in the first place. So yes, in a sense, that transformation process was kind of part of it. But you know, it doesn't always have to be serious. You can have fun doing it as well, you know. And that's something that perhaps I'd like to hang on to for a second.
And I mean, that really was the challenge of the project: is working with how do you express the sublime in the most base territories of eBay you can possibly find.
Can I ask you to pass the microphone, actually?
This gentleman on the aisle.
Oh, thanks.
One of the things I find so fascinating about eBay is how commerce has become play or entertainment. And we're starting to get to that realm. That's something that you're talking about. It can be light. But I'm just curious if you all have anything to say about the quality of the individual directions this has taken and how it relates to entertainment. I mean, you know, eBay now, not only can you go buy stuff, but it becomes a place for reference for objects, as well as a place for which people find something obscure, like, you know, piece of bread that looks like a shroud of Christ, and then they send that to all their friends, and it becomes a reference point for humor. I think it's really interesting.
I was struck by Ken's remark, you know, talking about having lost the pleasure of collecting, and you almost brought out, in a sense, a fetishization of the market itself, a kind of eros of the marketplace, which is like other forms of eros, killed in its full satiation. And I wonder, maybe this is a play question for you.
I gave up book collecting, but I got seriously into Fisher Price Little People for a while. on eBay, but my kid got to play with them all and destroy them. I have no way of knowing how scientifically valid this is, but there's this theory called dark flow, which is that our universe is leaking into another one. Right. And it makes sense of certain pieces of data to hypothesize it this way. So I just wanted to think about not just the dark matter of the art world, but the dark flow of something like eBay, where it leaks into all of these other domains, where one is entertainment, another is the art world, possibly, that it might not be, to go back to Alan's point, it might not be completely separate, that it might actually, things might bubble up into that sphere as well. That you could just spend all your time, I have friends who are just so into real estate porn that they need a 12-step program, but it's all on the internet, yeah? It's just sort of like, but look at this condo, you know, there's no intention to buy anything whatsoever, as you say, it becomes an entertainment in itself to observe. But maybe that's one of the functions the market always had, yeah? This is the flaneur and the arcades and so on, is that we enjoy the pleasure of seeing the world through the prism of it being potentially saleable, you know? It makes the world for us, in a sense. Even if we don't have the money power in our pocket to actually be the person who can answer to its call.
What about the way that reverses the Benjaminian idea, right? I mean, instead of all being together in the arcades and having the occasion of a kind of social pageantry as a collective, and you know, the emergence of something like the nation in that seeing of itself, this is your friend alone, presumably, doing real estate porn, and there's this kind of crazy fragmentation. Does that... Anything else?
Well, but it's the world of things has come to us. You know, so a world of images that duplicates a world of things has come to us. So there's, if you like, a declension from being to having to appearing. This is Guy Debord, of course. So now the world of appearances becomes the sociology of the sociology of images stands in for the sociology of things, which stands in for a sociology of people that we don't really have.
Or on this, or on other things. Who else is out there? There's one. Behind you, a step back. Thank you.
I don't need it. This isn't really like my thing, so I'm gonna grapple with it in the way that seems pleasure she got just from doing the project, and it wasn't about, obviously, the monetary value from it. So do you think that maybe you have a responsibility to your fellow people? I mean, I know that you were allowed to work in someone's home at Mildred Lane to produce it, and that someone gave you the money, the original money, to found the project. Do you feel a responsibility to give back if you do make money off the project?
Responsibility. I'm giving that one to Mark.
What's interesting in this question is who is the who? Yeah. Is that cabinet? Is that Mildred's Lane? Is that the people who? I mean, essentially, who owns this now? Is a really interesting question in a sense, because it was made, you know, finished at about an hour and 20 minutes ago, and it would be kind of hard to, you know. So we're all kind of playing a game with that, and I think that's quite a funny. That in itself is quite a funny question, but I mean I think that all of us involved with this, I mean you would have to go back to, you know, should we pay Graham back for the train ride he took up to Boston to arrange the donation for this? Should we pay all the people who work here at Cabinet for the press release that they typed and sent off? And you know, so if we started to calculate value, where would we start to calculate that? And there's just so many people who participated in some way in this. And you know, I think that's certainly not in the spirit of the way the piece was produced, and it's not in the spirit of the way so many of the things that happen in this room and this office happen.
Deliciously casuistical deconstruction of the notion of responsibility. Right? Once you start down that road, where would we stop? Just forget the whole thing. No. Beauty, okay? Anybody else want the question of, I mean, this is a utopian question in some sense, or what floats over this is the question of utopia. And of course, yeah. I mean,
well, I guess, you know, for me, in this story, as you talk about your sister and we talk about all the different participants, there is this question of motivation. And it's clear that there's a general assumption and belief, and I think it's probably relatively correct, that the reason people participated and gave their labor wasn't money. And I'm always interested in that phenomenon because we're, as a society, we talk so much about being motivated by money, but in fact, in really quite a lot of our lives, we're motivated by other things. You know, I'm thinking about this, the gentleman who spoke over there about his kind of sorrow at the idea of the dark matter of the art world. And I actually find the idea of all of that dark energy and dark matter, there's some sadness in the thought that all of the prestige is collected in the light, but lots of interesting stuff happens over there that we're not looking at, and I think part of the point of Greg Shalette's idea of bringing it up is to actually say, well, yes, the beam of light happens to be, you know, over there, but our interest doesn't have to stop with the beam of light. Our interest in why somebody is spending a Sunday afternoon painting a landscape is my interest in that is profound, and my interest lasts whether or not that landscape is good or bad. It's not all about. I don't actually think all of the good art is collected in the light and all the bad art is in the dark. But even if that were the case, that wouldn't make what happens, what goes on, what are all the motivations. And in that dark is all of the, almost all political art, almost all interventionist art, almost all art which consists of, besides Tino Segal's, actions rather than objects. You know, huge amounts of interesting activity that we could, you know, we could be curious about and delight in for its own sake.
Yeah,
can I say, let's just not give the guy back his $1,000, though. Well, partly because it's insulting, right?
Yeah.
It's insulting.
Plus, he's already taken the tax credit on it.
Exactly. Like we underestimate what a huge problem it is for people with large amounts of money to give it away. So the last thing you want to do is give someone this additional problem of giving it back. We're supposed to be the unproductive thing you feel good about. So, yeah, I'm voting against that.
Let me be clear. I never suggested giving him back. No. I suggested giving Cabinet.
I stand corrected.
That's
a deceit. So I want to make sure. I'd like us to stay with this idea of the dark matter of the art world for another second, because I do think it's you're having immediately seen this in the tragic mode is also a little bit at odds with something like a euphoria that I felt when you laid the idea out. That sense that, I mean, it depends on how hard you want to push the scientific metaphor, but it is, of course, the dark matter that holds everything together. I mean, right? That's the idea, is that we can't explain why the thing coheres at the level of cosmology absent positing this dark matter. And so I'd just like to get the panelists a little bit more in on this idea.
Could we say, I mean, but that, is this something that's unique to our world? I mean, couldn't we say that there is a dark matter in the entertainment community, that there's a dark matter, dare I say, in the sports world, too? And is our situation really, really different from that?
Yeah, all right. I mean, I think I have an answer to that, but it's a real challenge.
Yeah, no, give yours. Let's see.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that what this important intervention points us toward is thinking more deeply about the relationship between labor and leisure. So, you know, the classical formulation of the relationship between labor and leisure, so I'm thinking now, you know, an Aristotelian account, is that you labor for leisure the way that you fight wars for peace. So it would be impossible to get those two things confused. And it is characteristic of the transition to modernity that leisure, understood under this quasi-aristocratic classical vision as the highest form of life, with pure contemplation as the highest of all, being a philosopher, that gets domesticated and mobilized in the marketplace, completely transvaluated, so that leisure comes to serve the function of labor. And that's hobbies,
Right. So the idea is that the working man has leisure so that he can bust his ass those 12 working days. You better let him blow off some steam playing football, drinking, whatever it is, darts. Leisure becomes like recharging of the batteries under a capitalist system. And what was previously the end, the telos of the whole business, gets turned around as merely a helpmeet to the, you know, mobilization of the marketplace. So in that sense, your question's perfectly legitimate. What about the fact that there are hobbyists?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, the sports industry is certainly a much larger industry than the art industry. This certainly generates much more economy than art.
Yeah, to be sure. But I guess the dynamic that binds all of those together and that still, I think, holds it in front of us as worth considering is the extent to which we tend to take a deprecatory posture with respect to those hobbies, which are obviously just the things that people do to keep them functional, to be at the keyboard for the 8 hours a day, and that the hobby has turned out to serve labor rather than, under this, again, problematically aristocratic vision, being itself the highest form of life, you know, at the end. I see a few more questions. I see you keep us on time. We have a little more time?
Two more questions?
Maybe two more questions. How about here and then here? There's the microphone if you'd like.
On the subject of work, a little bit more generally, somebody said something really interesting to me once about work. I was complaining about my job, and he said, well, the thing about jobs is that if they didn't suck, no one would pay you to do them. And I thought that was really interesting, because a lot of times the difference between a hobby and the work that you do so you can pay your rent and buy groceries is that your hobby you do for love. I mean, you do it because you enjoy doing it. No one needs to pay you to do it. And so there's a really interesting thing to me, the idea that your labor is worth more when it's unpleasant, in which, in this case, you haven't added any value to the $999 because you like doing it.
It's hard to go.
That's great.
Isn't it all about serving a different purpose, serving a higher purpose? I'm thinking back to our putative alchemists running around convincing princes and potentates to support them. What they're actually doing is utilizing a particular strategy there in order to further their own interests. It's a slightly different way of looking at it. It's not necessarily leisure. It's about creating an optimum environment for them to achieve their own goals. Now, it's the identification of those goals which becomes interesting under those circumstances. Now, that might be, I want to paint pictures of sheep on a Sunday. That might be a goal, but I have to go to work 5 days a week in order to do that. But it's still, I still think it's very strategic. And I you know, in a sense, behind what you were saying is that there's some kind of I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. It's something about being passively doing those things, and I'm quite sure that perhaps you don't need to be passive, and certainly my favourite alchemist wouldn't be.
But I just figured out where all the alchemists went. They're now called consultants.
Yeah.
Make promises that they can transmute one thing into another to give them the power so that their high goals will be realized. Yeah. That's a consultant.
Yeah, oh, real estate, you know.
I'm obviously a very good last question.
Go ahead and use the mic, though, because we got so many people in the back. Not on. Help.
Hello?
Is there an on?
Yeah.
Hello?
Oh.
I think it's a really interesting concept, this idea of dark matter, but like, I guess I'm looking for more of a clarification after we've talked about it a bit. Like, is dark matter then any effort that has no value in the marketplace? Is that how we're defining dark matter?
I think, you know, we could look at it that way. I think that might be interesting. In Greg Shalette's formulation, it's really about attention. So it's an attention economy story about which kinds of art activity have social prestige and are part of a sort of a fairly small and definable network of actors. In fact, there's plenty of people in there who aren't making much money, like art critics say. So it's not all about money, but it's about who and what we value and why, or who's having a conversation within a certain small number of signs and symbols and ideas, right? So the same landscape of a sheep painted by somebody within that group of people would have a very, very different social meaning than that. And or even if, like Jim Shaw, they took from thrift stores paintings and put them in their shows. So he did that as a series of artworks, so thrift store paintings. So they change in meaning when they're attached to his name. And that's what I was thinking about this project too, is that one of the ways in which objects gain meaning, gain value, is by becoming associated with prestigious names. And like in the gift exchange I don't know how many people have read the story of the Kula gift exchange in the Trobriand Islands, but it's this kind of great story about how in this group of islands, the main entertainment and sort of social and political activity of this whole large group of societies is trading these armbands, big shell armbands that go one way around the circle, and necklaces that go another way around the circle. It's a pretty famous story about gift economies. But one of the things about the most valuable ones of these objects is what makes them valuable is the history of people who've had them. So now these objects have gone from not having any names attached to them. Now they have actually quite a few names attached to them. They have Cabinet's name, they have Mark's name and Robert's name and the names of Mildred's Lane. You know, so all of these names now have conferred, I rather suspect, quite a substantial amount of potential monetary value on the same objects.
I hope so.
is that may be just the right place to end on that hopeful note. Anybody out there listening, well, get your checkbooks ready. Please join me in thanking our panelists and to the artists.